And hello, everyone. My name's John Willie. I'm here with my cohort, my unindicted co-conspirator, Michael H. Price.
And
this is the special bonus edition of the Forgotten Horrors podcast. It's going to be kind of a shorter one, a little looser, but I don't think we get much looser than we usually are when we do these. We're just going to talk a little bit about some of the films you might think about watching for your Halloween viewing. And we've tried to choose stuff that the whole family can watch.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if your kids, and that was a persistent thing, that kids won't watch black and white films. Has that been your experience, Michael?
Not lately. I find there's a new wave of discovery going on, a more adventurous spirit.
Good, good.
We can thank Turner Classic Movies Network for a great deal of that interest.
Well, you know, I think that's probably right. Well, I tell you what, let's just take it, we'll just go by decades, and I would like to start with my favorite horror film of all time, and that's Freaks from 1932.
Todd Browning, man.
Oh, one of the great outsider pictures of all time.
Yep.
One of the most unsettling pictures, I think, of all time, and gives you more sympathy and more empathy, I guess is more correct, for the other than any other picture I can think of. Is this a favorite of yours?
That definitely is, and I always try to watch it again in close quarters with Universal's picture from that same period called Imitation of Life.
Oh, my, what a jump there. I know what you're talking about. Give me that.
Tremendous lot in common, betraying one's own kind for a chance at false normalcy.
My. Never thought of Imitation of Life in that way, but you're right.
Fanny Hurst was very attuned to that outsider vibe, and although her topic is race relations, and Freaks is concerned with the plight of being the, an alternate title for the film was Nature's Mistake.
Right, a roadshow title, that's right.
Yeah, exactly, and both of those make a beautiful unit. There's a bit, each is guilty of a bit of copping out to the stick with your own kind kid argument, but they both address that. So the catalyst in Freaks is the dwarf who wants to be married to a big woman, and the catalyst in Imitation of Life is the very pale-skinned black girl who wishes to not be recognized as what she really is. And both sympathetic, although there's an element of menace in Freaks that you don't find in Fanny Hurst. At the same time, they both make that same argument very, very nicely, and I caught them together accidentally years ago and said, okay, there's a perfect double bill.
Boy, that's right. I never thought about that. And that's the original. I think it's been remade, a couple of times?
Remade once in 59.
With Lana Turner, I think?
With Lana Turner, a much glossier picture. The Depression period Imitation of Life is about as gritty as Freaks.
Great. Great. Well, there you go. Have all the kids over and show them Imitation of Life.
That's a traumatizing. Hell, that traumatizes me.
That's right. Now, you said you had a couple. I've got a couple from the 40s. What have you got from the 40s?
Well, I would. You can't go wrong with Rondo Hatton,
no matter
how cheap or shabby the circumstances.
No, you can't.
Of a poor fellow's exploitation, speaking of deformity,
yes,
freakishness. Rondo, did you ever meet Tiny Ron, the actor who played Rondo in the Rocketeer movie?
Did not, no.
He was much bigger than Rondo. Rondo was not a giant.
No, see him in the films. He's a pretty small guy. Yeah.
Right, but he played, they shot him to look gigantic.
Right.
Tiny Ron, of course, is a much bigger man, but he wore the makeup very well. I had the occasion to visit with Tiny Ron around the time the Rocketeer film was made. He said, I found out everything I could about Rondo Hatton in order to play him right. So it's one big difference. I can go home and take my makeup off.
So he was not acromegaelic at all, like,
oh, dear,
like Rondo.
No, not like Rondo. Mm-hmm. The two films would be The House of Horrors and The Brute Man,
mm-hmm.
both from 1946,
mm-hmm.
Both featuring the same central character, a fellow called the Creeper.
Yes.
The Brute Man is a rare instance of what today the trendies call a prequel.
Yes, right.
Relating how the Creeper got to be the Creeper. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a biographical study of Rondo Hatton's life.
It is, without a lot of the monster stuff that
right.
the murders that happen in it, yeah.
Exactly. It's a fictionalized biographical treatment. And although released by different studios, both were made by Universal.
Right. As I understand it, Michael, once Rondo Hatton died, they were grooming him to be a horror star, and actually were mm-hmm. well along in the process.
Right.
And then he died, and they were left with the Brute Man, and that was a kind of a dead end, so sold it to our favorite low-budget Gower Gulch Poverty Row studio, PRC.
PRC. And, of course, that coincides with one of those periods in history where Universal management said, no more B-movies.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was part of it, too, huh?
That was part of it, too. Uh-huh. And they would say that, oh, we're gonna do nothing but epics and prestige dramas and big musicals and things like that. And every time reality would kick in and they would realize the only money makers they were making were B movies.
B horror movies specifically.
B horror
right?
movies.
Sure.
Yes.
Now they did do, I think they made a little money with those B sarong movies at some point, did they not?
Well, sure.
Those little
yeah,
vest pocket musicals.
But they kind of marketed those as though they were more earnest productions.
Right.
You know, I mean, the Helly Abbott and Costello pictures were B-movies.
Well, of course they were, sure. I mean, you look at most of the horror output that we love and revere as classic movies on the Universal mm-hmm. canon, those were B-pictures.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. Well, and speaking of that, there's one of those that I love above probably all the others, although I will say I have a real soft spot for Jungle Captive, another Rondo Hatton picture.
Oh, yeah.
And with Vicki Lane in the Aquanetta role, and we love Aquanetta in the first two, but that was like one of their last, as I remember it, that was one of their last attempts at having a monster character with Paula the Ape Woman, right?
A franchise.
Uh-huh. Did the three films, two of them with Aquanetta and then the last one with Vicki Lane. But the one that I want to talk about is House of Dracula.
Oh, boy.
I love House of Dracula. Now, it's got Martha O'Driscoll, I believe, in it, and was one of our Oklahoma girls who went
yeah.
to Hollywood to become a star and was a B-picture star. And it's got one of my favorite all-time Draculas with John Carradine.
Who looks just like Bram Stoker described him.
Does he really?
Very, very close.
Well, he does a wonderful job. And no fangs, of course, on John Carradine.
he
didn't need them at all.
With and, that mustache and that voice. Mm.
And I don't think, honestly, although I know of Mice and Men, but I don't think that Lon Chaney has ever been better. I think he's so good in this. And the idea of, at least for a moment, that everything is restored, normalcy is restored, and that Larry Talbot can be, I don't want to be a spoiler here, but that Larry Talbot can be a heroic figure, just tickles me to death.
Oh, it's a very sympathetic and touching portrayal.
It absolutely is.
And he reprises that that approach to the character in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
With not as positive results.
Not as positive results,
mm-hmm.
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, it's but you can tell when Chaney's really stretching.
Yes, you can. And I think he did some of that in those Inner Sanctum pictures too.
I was just about to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a really good noir leading man.
He was, and even though they had the B picture directors, of course, and they were all B pictures, short films. Reginald Lee Borg directed some of them, and they were still gave him the chance to be a leading man. And I think I think he really enjoyed doing those.
Dapper, handsome.
Yes.
Classy.
Yeah. Now, the other film I'd like to bring up from the 40s is The Body Snatcher. We love our RKO Val Luton pictures. There's not a bad one in the bunch. I even like the Seventh Victim. I even like the Western that he did, the couple Westerns that he did. But but this one, to me, Boris Karloff and Henry Daniell, if that's how you pronounce his name, and
I hope it's exactly.
Henry Daniell, have never been better. Now, Lugosi has a throwaway role. Bela Lugosi is in it, and it's supposed to be Karloff and Lugosi. But it is actually Henry Daniell and Boris Karloff, and it's essentially a take on the Burke and Hare, Burke and Hare real-life body snatchers who were in Scotland, who were robbing graves to supply the medical schools. And this is basically just a complete takeoff of those pictures. And I just think that is a brilliant movie. And if no one's seen the last 10 minutes, and if you can watch that last 10 minutes without getting your flesh crawled.
Oh, that is a creepy finale.
And it's just it's just a very sturdy, well-structured picture. It showed you what Val Luton could do with no budget. The producer, and I can't, now all of a sudden I just blanked, which was it, Robert Wise or was it Turner that directed
That's Robert Wise.
That is Robert Wise, yeah. And it's terrific.
Timing is everything, and this picture has it. Oh, man, does it have timing. Even the Lugosi role is treated on screen better than it is in the script.
Yes.
When I first saw The Body Snatcher on TV, I was in grade school, and Bacardi Rum had a series of billboards up all over the country, gigantic billboards showing this satanic face and the slogan, Bacardi Rum, it's devilishly good. And I saw that picture and said, oh, my God, that's that devil from the Bacardi Rum billboards. And it was like, okay. And then pretty soon thereafter, Danielle shows up in the Four Skulls of Jonathan Drake.
Sure.
And on a really good episode of Thriller on television.
He did two or three thrillers, as I remember.
I believe he did. I haven't looked at him in a while. But, boy, that body snatcher thing. Hey, this guy, how come this guy isn't famous? Well, he is famous selling rum, but everybody thinks he's the devil.
Oh, and he was just so good. He held his own with Lugosi as the doctor with a secret in his past. And basically, one of the great, I used to teach a horror movie class at Oklahoma State University and spent a little time doing that. And I talk about what a wonderful example of the doppelganger that particular film is. The two sides of the same coin with Karloff's character and Danielle's character. It's just wonderful. Yeah. I really recommend it. 1950s, I looked up several pictures that I really liked, and I think for the 50s, if you want one from the 50s, I think I'd go with Bucket of Blood.
Oh boy.
I love it. It's just like much later on Hollywood Boulevard was an homage to Dick Miller. This is really the film that, I mean, Dick Miller, established Dick Miller, as far as I'm concerned, is the king of those 50s low-budget horror pictures.
And established him as a good luck actor for practically everybody he ever worked with.
That's right.
Kind of like Keenan Wynn, that people would cast those guys because partly they were great, partly because it was believed they brought good luck to a production. And, I just noticed Dick's character from A Bucket of Blood shows up again in a later Corman production called Chopping Mall.
Yes, the Walter Paisley character.
Yes, and that has, this past week, was released in a nice, handsome Blu-ray edition.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, now he's also in the Looney Tunes movie as Walter Paisley, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I believe so. Yeah, it's those little in jokes, or you might call them miniature sequels. Hey, I thought you got killed in A Bucket of Blood. Well, here I am again. You know,
right.
That sort of thing. Gremlins, the same effect. The beauty of A Bucket of Blood is that it works on a level of really. Low comedy with a really high IQ. Reconcile those two. very smart film that, also delivers the shock value.
Mm-hmm.
And has a little bit of improv going on in it.
Well, and it has a lot to say about art and how art's received and why it's received and the way it's received.
And a documentary function as well,
yes,
showing that whole pretentious art and poetry scene.
The beatnik scene. He becomes king of the beatniks because he finds out, I don't think he's giving anything away to say that he becomes king of the beatniks by becoming a great sculptor, and what he's actually doing is covering dead bodies in clay.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the whole film, but the way they play it out is just wonderful.
Well, it's a gimmick Corman told me he borrowed from a 32 RKO called Secrets of the French Police.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Covering the murder victim in clay and passing it off as a statue.
Interesting. Well, it works very well in Bucket of Blood, and that leads us into 1960 and a film that we talked about in the last podcast we did on Female on the Beach, and that's Tormented.
Yeah.
And I love that picture. Of course, you know, I was in love with Susan Gordon, the young lady that was in it. We're about the same age. And as you know, I've written about it for Forgotten Horrors and in other places as well, and written about her and Bird Eye Gordon. And I really believe of all of the pictures that Bird Eye Gordon has made, this is my favorite of his.
Yeah, and it fits into that film noir category, too, except with a really strong combination of ghost story and psychological horror.
Yes, and what's interesting about it, one of the things interesting about it, is that it is not any of Bert I. Gordon's, doesn't have any of his playing with size, which is what he was known for, whether it's Attack of the Puppet People or The Spider or Amazing Colossal Man. That was his trademark, and there's none of his trademark here. It's a straight ghost story.
Yeah.
And it's a good one too. Susan Gordon has never been, she's what, I think she's 12 years old when this one was done. And I remember seeing it at the theater, and it sucker punched me. What a wonderful picture. Finally, I want to talk about one, you know, I don't think you can go wrong. And I know that you knew William Castle. And I interviewed Rob White, his primary scriptwriter, and I talked to him at length. But I don't think you can go wrong for Halloween with any William Castle picture. I think of all the filmmakers that ever got behind a camera, that William Castle is the one that understood that creepy but not too creepy Halloween thing.
Mm-hmm. Playing with the audience.
Playing with the audience. That it wasn't
giving real. Giving them a big old goose and reassuring them at the same time.
That's right.
All in good fun.
And I think of all of his pictures, and he did some great ones, House on Haunted Hill and gosh, 13 Ghosts. And I think my favorite of his was The Nightwalker.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that was at the end, I suppose, or I guess it was right in the middle of the old girl genre, was it not?
Pretty close to that, yes.
With Barbara Stanwyck and Robert Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a scene in which Barbara Stanwyck is married, gets married in a kind of a dream sequence, that when I saw that originally at the theater, I threw popcorn five rows. It terrified me. Absolutely.
That's a picture that I wouldn't hesitate to mention in the same breath with Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you know, there's another one of the former actresses, the old girl actresses, and that's Rochelle Hudson.
Yep.
Who's an Oklahoma girl. It plays a secondary role in that. But Barbara Stanwyck is very good in it. And a guy that I knew a little bit, Hayden Rourke, who was Dr. Bellows later in I Dream of Jeannie.
Yeah.
We've talked about this show. As a matter of fact, we covered The Nightwalker in one of our podcasts. And I told that story. People can go back and listen to that if they're interested. But I actually went to Hayden Rourke's house and sat there and visited with him for an evening. It's one of the great moments of my life. And maybe that has something to do with the reason I like The Nightwalker so much.
Yeah. And it's got a great theme song melody.
Oh, does it ever. And that it's got one of those goofy William Castle introductions.
Mm-hmm.
About dreams and sleep, and even with all of this where you know he's trying to act like this is real, you know he's winking at you the whole time.
Yes, and that's why I treasure those encounters Castle and I had at my uncle's movie theaters when I was working, kind of a gopher slash usher.
Right.
And Castle would personally come through whenever he had a new picture coming out. This lasted for years. He would travel just like John Goodman, the Castle surrogate, does in Joe Dante's film Matinee.
Yes.
And he would visit each theater that had a track record of promoting his films.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like when we were wiring the auditorium at my uncle's big state theater for the Tingler, the audience gooser,
mm-hmm,
device.
Which were little tiny aircraft motors that they were putting in. Yes, right.
Like vibrating motors.
Mm-hmm.
We'd plant those things in there, and Castle would look up and say, they'll never know what hit them. It was like, yeah. And he had that wonderful, playful attitude throughout.
Yes, like our friend Dave Friedman.
Very much so.
Same thing.
That good old Carney man mentality.
Very much so. Very much Carney. Well, I'll close with a story that Rob White told me, who wrote House on Haunted Hill as well as The Tingler. He said in Westwood, in California, there was a theater that they were rigging for the things you were talking about, and they were basically little aircraft motors. And Michael, as I recall it, you didn't put them behind every seat, right? It was like every third or fourth seat.
They were randomly placed, actually.
Right. So people would buzz the bottom of their spines and make them jump.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a joy buzzer. They were glorified joy buzzers.
Very
right?
much so, but all connected to a single trigger up in the projection booth.
Well, so Rob White says that they have got these all set up, and they've got it all wired up to the projection booth. And it's the Sunday before the William Castle picture, The Tingler, comes in, and they're showing the Nun story. Now, there's a group of people watching the Nun story, and according to Rob White, at the very saddest part of the Nun story, the projector for that, the projectionist for that night, looked over at this button he hadn't seen before. He says, "I wonder what this does."
Oh.
And he pushed it, and all of these old ladies came jumping up out of the seats while this sad part of the Nun story was going on. Now, there's if that's not the spirit of Halloween, I don't know what is.
Beautiful. Just beautiful.
We want to wish a happy Halloween to everyone.
Yeah.
And Michael, happy Halloween to you.
Likewise. I think we're going to have a good one.
Be back to you before you know it.
Won't be long.
Bye.